Cologne, 27th November 1263, south of the cathedral building site. It had been a restless autumn day. A rumor was spreading through the city. The archbishop was planning to have the good people, so the rich citizens of the city, arrested. In this way, Engelbert II von Falkenburg would make another attempt to regain power in Cologne once and for all. What the Cologne city ruler did not realize, however, was that he would soon be in dire straits. "Come on now," said one of the men who had secretly gathered in front of the archbishop's palace. "Let's show him who is really in charge in Cologne." The surrounding Cologne citizens nodded and drew their swords. Then they walked firmly and resolutely towards the palace entrance. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the city of the history of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. Last episode, we finished with the saga of Hermann Grimm and his fight against the Lion. This time we're back in the traditional, the real story. It ended with the bloody recapture of the city wall and the city gates on 8th June 1262 with fierce fighting throughout the day over the fortress-like Bayernturm Tower in particular, which ultimately fell into the hands of the citizens of Cologne. You can find out now how the aforementioned event came about 1.5 years later. Cologne city ruler Archbishop Engelbert II von Falkenburg had made a big gamble in 1262. He had not cancelled the disempowerment of the citizens by his predecessor Konrad von Hochstaden, as he promised when he took office. No, on the contrary, he had tried to take it even further. Two episodes ago, we learned that he had gone too far. While his predecessor Konrad von Hochstaden had been able to rely on an alliance of the dissatisfied within Cologne citizenry, consisting of the craft guilds and other middle-class merchants, he now, Engelbert II, had the whole of Cologne against him with his claims to complete city rule. Engelbert II had tried to counteract this by force. However, the people of Cologne did not tolerate the occupation of the city walls and gates and recaptured them by force. This was now the situation in summer of 1262. Cologne had driven the archbishop out of the city, but he was far from defeated. The area directly beyond the wall was still under the archbishop's control. This was actually a bad starting position for Cologne, but the city now knew too well how to play the game of power. If the outskirts of the city were surrounded by enemy territory, how about a Uno reverse card? By simply surrounding the archbishop's territory so that he was also surrounded by his enemies. We'll get to how to do that as a city in a moment, but let's stay in June 1262 for now. Engelbert II had now been driven out of the city. Engelbert could not afford another direct attack on the city. The morale of his troops was too low for that, and he probably didn't have the strength for it either. Like every pre-modern ruler, Engelbert II was dependent on the troops of his vassals in his domain, and these were probably not really prepared, let alone motivated, to provide their liege lord with sufficient troops for another adventure before or in front of Cologne. Especially as the Count of Berg was still flirting with the idea of intervening in the conflict in favor of the city of Cologne. So the archbishop needed time to gather himself. Barely a week after his humiliating defeat at the Bayernturm Tower, he agreed to seek peace with the city of Cologne. In an atonement agreement, he promised the citizens of Cologne great things. He, the archbishop, would no longer claim the income from the lucrative Rhine mills which supplied the city with flour for himself alone, but would share it with the city. The same applied to the beer penny, a type of beer tax levied in Cologne. He also promised the city a share of the customs revenue that was collected in Cologne at the behest of the archbishop as the customs lord. In return, the archbishop received a one-off payment of 6,000 marks from the city. The fact that the archbishop had really turned everyone in the city against him is also evidenced by the document of this agreement. Exactly 60 Cologne men signed as witnesses and guarantors on behalf of the city of Cologne. Only half of them were from the Richerzeche elite, consisting of patrician families such as the Overstolzens or the wise men from the Mühlengasse. But there were also names we had heard before, like the Gier family, Jude family, Kleingedank family, or the Schärfgen family. The remaining other 30 men, however, were from the wards, the city boroughs, the craft guilds, and other smaller merchant families. The signatories include people who were still considered allies of the archbishop under Conrad von Hochstaden and who looked enviously on the dominance of the Richerzeche. All of these 60 men vouched above all for the city lord receiving his 6,000 marks. If this did not happen, these 60 men would have to pay for it with their property. Here we see that we had a broad alliance in Cologne of the Richerzeche, the College of the Magistrates, the still emerging city council and the community, as well as the craft guilds. They all still existed side by side. The position of the city council as the highest city body had not yet been established, but the development towards this would soon be recognizable. In terms of concept, the agreement also stipulated that the Great Arbitration of 1258 was still valid and in force. Everything that had been decided since then, or rather imposed on Cologne, was not valid anymore. This included the disempowerment of the patricians in Cologne in 1259, as well as everything that Engelbert II himself had endeavored to do since taking office in 1261. In return, the archbishop was allowed to return to Cologne and reside there again from his palace by the cathedral. Nice, isn't it? Peace forever? Not quite, because Engelbert II was playing for time and was looking for a way out of this unfortunate situation for him. And where did the archbishop seek it or find it? Far away from Cologne, in the Eternal City, in Rome. Well, north of Rome, but close enough. In the autumn of 1262, Archbishop Engelbert II made his way to Orvieto, the residence of the popes in the Middle Ages, located in a small Italian town in the mountains around 120 kilometers north of Rome. How did he justify his departure from Cologne? Well, the archbishop was still quite new in office, so of course he would have to have a chat with the pope. There he also would pick up the fashionable accessoire, the pallium, to which the archbishops of Cologne are entitled to. A pope awarded this to bishops who held an important position within the church. A good excuse to jet off to Italy. In Orvieto, Engelbert II met Pope Urban IV as well as a pupil of Albertus Magnus. Thomas Aquinas resided here in a Dominican monastery and was active in teaching there. At a papal court in the mountains north of Rome, Engelbert II dropped his mask. Of course he accepted the pallium with a kiss, but even more important to him was the pope's support in his endeavors to bring down Cologne. Crazy, really. Because Engelbert was so determined to bring Cologne back under his control that he ignored almost everything else around him, which would turn out to be a big mistake. He pressurized the pope to give him his blessings to break the oaths he had made to the city of Cologne. As I said, you don't break oaths just like that in those days. It could earn you a direct ticket to hell after your death. But it's a good thing that someone like the pope, the vicar of Christ on earth, was able to sort this out. But apparently he was either not directly willing to authorize the Cologne city ruler to do so, or Engelbert II waited until it was safe to return to Germany, the onset of winter and all that. The two celebrated Christmas together at the turn of the year 1263, and on 13th January 1263, Engelbert II finally got what he wanted. The Pope released him from the agreed obligations to the city of Cologne with a document. Incidentally, this was shortly after the last installment of the 6,000 marks from the citizens of Cologne to the archbishop that had been paid off. So why did the Pope do that? Well, the Pope's reasoning was that the agreement had been imposed on the Archbishop of Cologne by force. This was no way to deal with a representative of the Church, so the agreement was therefore invalid. The citizens of Cologne, who had once been expelled under Conrad von Hochstaden, remember the story about the Castle Are, continued to be ostracized, were punished by the Church, and had to leave Cologne again immediately. I think you realize what that means, of course. Engelbert II had decided to revoke the peace of June 1262, and he returned to the Rhineland in the spring of 1263 with the intention of taking up arms against Cologne again. But in this case, history repeats itself. In Cologne, of course, people had not remained naive and something like that as far as the city ruler was concerned, because when Engelbert II prepared for war against the city, he was in for shock. The Count of Jülich, directly west of Cologne, ruling over a vast territory of land, the Count of Katzenelnbogen, I know it's a funny name, the Counts of Berg and Geldern, the Duke of Limburg, the great rival of the Cologne Church at the end of the 13th century, all those people were on the side of the citizens of Cologne and were ready to deploy their troops against the Archbishop to protect the city of Cologne. How did Cologne manage that? If you look at a map, for example on thehistoryofcologne.com, you will see that the citizens of Cologne had virtually put all the large neighbors in the vicinity of Cologne on their side. The Archbishop of Cologne was a powerful imperial prince, allowed to be one of the seven electors for the imperial throne, but also important militarily, no question, but it was impossible for him to win a war against all his neighbors at the same time. For some time now, cities in the Holy Roman Empire had been forbidden to enter into alliances with foreign rulers without the permission of their feudal lord. Something that was happening here at this moment, obviously, in 1263. But Cologne, as always flexible in matters of loyalty, had found a loophole to circumvent the ban on alliances. Because the Counts of Jülich, Geldern, Berg, and Katzenelnbogen, as well as the Duke of Limburg, were not foreign rulers after all in their eyes. They were citizens of Cologne, and therefore always ready to defend their hometown. Wait a minute, excuse me. That sounds strange, doesn't it? It is. But yes, that's what happened. In order to circumvent the ban on alliances with foreign rulers, the alliance partners were made citizens of Cologne, and as such, they naturally had to stand up for the defense of Cologne, their hometown, so to speak. It was a loophole that quickly caught on in medieval Germany. Just 1 year later, Oberwesel would follow Cologne's example, Erfurt in 1277, Wetzlar in 1285, Worms in 1287, Mainz in 1293, and today's Swiss city of Bern in 1296. Here too it became clear that Cologne was once again leading the way in the communal movement. Whatever happened in Cologne in terms of urban autonomy endeavors vis-à-vis the feudal lord, Cologne led the way. Of course, these counts and the duke did not do this out of Christian charity and Cologne's local patriotism, which they suddenly seemed to have discovered for themselves. No, it wasn't just the archbishop who always needed new money for his political ventures, but also the rest of the Lower Rhine nobility, and so the citizens of Cologne gave what they so desperately needed, their money. In return for payment, the nobility became citizens of the city of Cologne and promised to help Cologne in the war. Each year they received a contribution in return for that. The title of citizen was also hereditary, so if the Count of Jülich died, his successor automatically inherited the citizenship of Cologne. But anyone who now thinks that they were all residents of Cologne from now on is mistaken. They were not required to reside in Cologne permanently. This was a win-win situation for the Rhenish nobility. They were already annoyed by the great power of the Cologne Archbishopric on the Rhine and Westphalia, and in this way they were also able to push back the Cologne's church power and also get paid for it. Wow, cool. We can take a look at one of these agreements, which were recorded in writing. In May 1263, such a treaty was concluded between Cologne and the Count of Jülich. To be more precise, the agreement is dated 7th May 1263. And now listen, guys. The text of this document is available, but it's written in Middle Age German. I tried to translate it. It's really a totally other language. It's not even close between modern English and Shakespeare English. There's a bigger gap between that, between Middle German and today's German. But I try to translate it as good as possible. If I get some words wrong, in your opinion, that's okay. So, let's quote from the document. Quote, "In the name of God, Amen. Let all who see this letter know that we, William, Count of Jülich, together with the honorable people, the judges, the magistrates, the council, and the citizens of the city of Cologne, have decided with the consent of our kinsmen and our council that we will allow those who currently belong to Jülich to become citizens of Cologne and their heirs as well, so that our descendants, who are Counts of Jülich, may also grant them these rights and liberties to which the citizens of Cologne are entitled, within our lands and our domains, in our jurisdiction, and also in other of our lands with their loyal inhabitants, that they should love and respect these new citizens as good, equal, and honorable people, just like the citizens of Cologne without guile. Let this be said, that we also recognize that the city and citizens of Cologne shall not defile or in any way treat anyone unequally the same as the others of Cologne, and that they recognize that the city and the citizens of Cologne should also treat our people as their own, in all their rights and in all things in which they find themselves, just as it has been right from time immemorial in written and unwritten laws. And also that when new citizens find themselves in the city, they are not disadvantaged. If someone who is a citizen of Cologne is forced to testify in another city through pressure or coercion, they shall not be forced to appear against their will if they do not do so voluntarily or do not voluntarily agree to do so. Even if they are sued in a city in which they do not reside, they shall not be required to appear there unless they do so voluntarily or have agreed to do so. Likewise, we and the citizens of Cologne, both in our lands and in theirs, shall not allow anyone to be sued in a foreign court, but in our own court." And the document goes on like that with stuff about hereditary rights and something like that, legal stuff. And it goes on with, "And if a citizen of Cologne goes from Cologne to Jülich and seeks help or protection there, he shall receive it, as provided for in our common agreement." And it goes forth and forth and ends with, "And in order that this agreement and this treaty may be faithfully preserved and honored, the city of Cologne has given us 100 marks of silver annually within Cologne as a fair income. All our heirs shall receive the same. So that our descendants do not lose this inheritance or do not have to sell it, they shall, like us, the Counts of Jülich, recognize these provisions sacredly and firmly as we have described them here. Therefore, we, the present Count of Jülich, have solemnly promised with true will and sworn consent that we will keep these words faithfully and without evil intent, and likewise that these regulations shall remain forever. We, the judges, the jurors, the council, and the citizens of Cologne also confirm with the letter that all these provisions are true and correct, and we have bound our mayors with the faithful will and sworn consent of us all to honor this agreement forever without evil intent. And if anything should change in this, then they shall remain in the city just as we, the said count on the one hand, and the city of Cologne on the other, have signed and sealed this letter. These persons were witnesses: Mr. Everard, the provost of St. George's in Cologne; Mr. Diedrich, the choir bishop of Trier; Mr. Walram of Jülich; Mr. Wilhelm, Mr. Harpen, and Mr. Wierich, the brothers of Frenz an der Inde; Mr. Arnold von Gümnich; Mr. Kuhne of Müllenarg; Mr. Gottfried, the marshal of Kells; Mr. Werner von Merode; Mr. Johann von Winden; Kuhn, the seneschal; Johann the clerk; the judges, the jurors, and the citizens of Cologne, as well as many other good men. This happened after God's birth in 1263, the Monday after the discovery of the cross, so meaning 7th May of 1263. It was made public among the citizens of Cologne, and we both, the Count of Jülich and the city of Cologne, sealed this letter together. End quote. Well, I don't think there's anything more to add about what the agreement contained, I think. With this system of external citizens, Cologne had created a system with which it would protect itself against external enemies for centuries to come. In Cologne itself, the citizens of Cologne created facts. The Collegiate of Magistrates was re-established on 30th May 1263. The chairman was, for wonder, Gerhard Overstolz and Eberhard Gier, both members of the Richterzeche. And as before, the family, the wise men from the Mühlengasse family, was also strongly represented. In terms of domestic and foreign policy, a change was already taking place in the city over which Engelbert II, coming back from Italy, despite his ambitions, had little influence. As already mentioned, the entire Rhineland seemed to have promised Cologne protection in the fight against the Archbishop, and history repeated itself. Once again, seeing this mighty force against him, Engelbert II chickened out and asked for peace, for a negotiated settlement with the city. No sooner said than done. I'll cut a long story short for you. On 25th August 1263, the Archbishop promised to honor the first agreement made a year earlier. In return, he once again received money from the city, this time 1,200 marks. In return, he promised not to abide the Pope's instructions, instructions that he himself had wrested from the Pope a few months earlier. This time, it was not only the citizens of Cologne who were called to testify for this new document, this new agreement, nor the Cologne Cathedral chapter, which was neutral in this dispute, was also called upon to testify. When both sides were in agreement, the papal document, which was to banish the citizens of Cologne again, was publicly torn up in front of the assembled cathedral chapter by none other than our old friend Albertus Magnus. This was the second agreement to settle the dispute between the city of Cologne and Archbishop Engelbert von Falkenburg. And two more of those would soon follow. Oh my. I know it's getting on my nerves too slowly. But even now, after August 1263, Engelbert II still didn't seem willing to honor his promises. Long-distance merchants from Cologne were frequently stopped at the Archbishop's custom stations and fleeced with fees and custom duties along the Rhine River, whether in the north at Neuss or south at Bonn and Andernach. This contradicted the agreements made in the first treaty and the second one. It was so disrespectful, also towards the Cologne Cathedral chapter and Albertus Magnus, who had recently acted as neutral mediators. And there was even more. When autumn came, Engelbert II, now being back in Cologne, came up with a new plan. The Archbishop wanted to chop off the heads of the citizens of Cologne. I mean, literally, not literally, but oh, maybe also literally. But let me continue. His plan was, instead of occupying all the city towers and gates with his troops, as he had done so in 1262, this time they were to capture the leading families of Cologne citizenry so that Engelbert II could finally impose his will on the city. The leader of this conspiracy was the Archbishop's brother, the already known Dietrich von Falkenburg. He had secretly smuggled fighters into the city over a period of days or maybe even weeks, a plan that was probably betrayed to the people of Cologne by one of those involved. The plan was simple, just wait until the next court hearing, at which many citizens, or most rich citizens, were usually present to watch the show, and where the Archbishop also was presiding as a chief judge. If that would happen this day, the fighters hired by Dietrich would come into play and take all of them, all those citizens, as prisoners. And here we return to the scene from the intro. On 27th November 1263, some 37 men got ahead of the conspiracy. They stormed the Archbishop's palace, which was in the shadow of the cathedral building site, overpowered the guards and arrested the Archbishop. They dragged the now powerless ruler halfway across the city, him protesting vehemently until they placed him under house arrest in a house called Zum Rosso, to the horse, in Rheingasse Alley, south of Heumarkt. His brother Dietrich von Falkenburg, who had been captured earlier, was already waiting there. What from today's perspective only fulfills the criminal offense of kidnapping and deprivation of liberty in inverted commas, so to speak, was an even greater outrage at the time. Although the Archbishop of Cologne was a secular ruler through and through, we see that every episode here, he was also a man of the church. Taking him prisoner against his will was an unparalleled scandal. This had never happened before in the city's history of Cologne. Even Anno II had never been taken prisoner, even though he was close of being murdered once. The 37 men involved in this raid must have known what was at stake, their own salvation. Because it was obvious that the church would excommunicate them for this action. Who were these men actually? Historical research assumes that it was not, as one might assume, someone from the Richterzeche or the Collegiate of Magistrates who were the masterminds behind that action. It was the young city council and its members that were preparing to compete with the previous civic institutions as a new citywide body. That's really something remarkable, because up until now we have hardly heard anything from the city council of Cologne, still being a mostly, not powerless, but inferior citywide body. So, Engelbert II was now caught. Caught like a chain dog on a leash in the courtyard, shortly before Christmas 1263, and yet, even in this situation, almost delirious, Engelbert II was still unwilling to give in, even though he had been so unlucky so far during his reign as Archbishop and city ruler of Cologne. But how that turns out, we'll deal with that another time. One thing is certain. At this point, the citizens of Cologne had prevailed. All attempts to turn Cologne back into a city ruled solely by the Archbishop, like in the 10th century, to turn back the clock, so to speak, had finally failed. Engelbert II was one of the last hopeless, unlucky Archbishops of Cologne to attempt this, and he would fail, big time, as we will hear next time. Let's leave it for today. Thanks to Andreas, Brigitte, Silvia, Heinrich, Jörg and Norbert for your tips via PayPal. The literature I used this time was Cologne in the 13th Century by Manfred Groten and Sources on the History of the City of Cologne, Volume 1, as well as Hugo Stehkämper and Karl Dietmar, Köln im Hochmittelalter or Cologne in the High Middle Ages. I look forward to your rating via the podcast app you trust. Please leave a rating there. It would make my day. Thank you very much for that. Auf Wiedersehen and until next time.